I'm John Kroll. Today on No Limits, along with our friends from Spirit and Place, we're going to talk about race. The hook is Spirit and Place's Powerful Conversations on Race series. My guests are Pam Hinkle, Executive Director of Spirit and Place, LaShonda Crow Storm, Director of Community Engagement, and Jeff Howell, a facilitator for the Powerful Conversations on Race series. Please join the conversation. Call 866-476-3881, email nolimits@wfyi.org, find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, or track us down on Twitter at WFYI. Now, this news. Welcome to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. In honor of Spirit and Place's Powerful Conversations on Race series, we're going to be talking about race today on No Limits. If you want to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI or on Twitter at WFYI. My guests are Pam Hinkle. She is Spirit and Place's Executive Director. And LaShonda Crow Storm, who is the Director of Community Engagement. And Jeff Howell, a facilitator for the Powerful Conversations on Race series. Well, welcome to all of you.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
It's good to have you here. So, Pam, I'll start with you. Tell me a little bit about what the Powerful Conversations on Race series is.
It is a series of monthly dialogues that we are hosting in an effort to help people be brave to talk about issues surrounding race in America. And I think what's going on in the world, a lot of us are want to do something, want to have conversations. We're wanting to know how we can help. And this is a way that people can enter into a carefully facilitated a dialogue around race. And then we're building it off of a particular book called The Charleston Syllabus, Readings in Race, Racism, and Racial Violence. And so people will have an opportunity to come once a month for the next year. They don't have to come every month, so it's designed as a drop-in kind of conversation. And we're and I'll let LaShonda talk a little bit more about the, you know, how we're going about that. But we're, as you know, Spirit and Place is all about using the arts, humanities, and religion to make the world a better place. So the facilitation practice is very unique. It's called the Civic Reflection Dialogue Technique, which uses a text or an artwork or a video to help people discuss shared values around these issues and have conversation.
What is there a particular day of the week that the conversations are taking place? LaShonda, she's, I think, turning toward you, so I'm guessing that means lifeline time here.
Well, they're going to be occurring at the second Sunday of the month, beginning this Sunday, September 10th, and they'll occur from 3 to 4:30, and we'll be at MLK Community Center, which is located at 40th West 40th Street.
You couldn't have gotten a much better news hook for this, and I'm saying that, you know, with some sense of irony, because the events themselves were tragic, to crystallize just how important these conversations are right now. You know, can you talk about, was that part of the thinking? I'm assuming that this series had to be in the works long before Charlottesville, but was it sort of a response to Charleston, or?
It wasn't really a response to Charleston. We had been working toward this, I want to say, for probably a year. About 2 years ago, the author of the book, Keisha Blaine, came to IUB in Bloomington and worked through their graduate mentoring center in a program called Trailblazers, which is really looking at how do you take scholarship and put it on the street so it works in community. We had worked with the graduate mentoring center to do some community discussions with Ms. Lane when she was here. So that's one track. Another track is for probably 5 years we've been working, long before I came to Spirit in Place, with Child Advocates, which runs the Undoing Racism Community Workshop. So they've, over the past 7 years, had 50 workshops in Indianapolis and trained about 2,000 people in central Indiana around these discussions about understanding the roots of racism. In that, I met Jeff. Mm-hmm. And this was an opportunity long before Charlotte. We had looked at working off of a previous program we've done called Gentrify, The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, where we spent the year talking about gentrification and what that process were. We looked at that process to see how we could bring these two elements together to spur a conversation on race. So it seems like we were already in the work. Things happened in Charlottesville, and it makes it even more pertinent that we continue to do this work around racism in our community.
Go ahead, Pam.
This also, you know, we were presented with a sudden opportunity that was fantastic, and that is the Indiana Humanities had a grant opportunity through funding from the NEH to for programs around race and ethnicity. And so we were well positioned at that time with the previous work to take advantage of that opportunity. So we got funding from Indiana Humanities as well as the Indianapolis Foundation to launch this particular program.
So, Jeff, how do you go about structuring conversations like this? I mean, there's a reason race has been called, well, slavery, I guess, has been called America's original sin. Mm-hmm. Race is obviously an outgrowth of that. So the racial tensions, how do you go about structuring those conversations?
Well, one of the things we do is we let the attendees know, you know, we have some set ground rules to guide the conversation, as it's a very sensitive topic, and we're there to respectfully have a dialogue to undo racism in Indianapolis. And so we want it to be a brave space where everyone can feel free to, without fear, share, and at the same time listen to understand, not be there to be defensive, but be there to learn, express input, and listen to understand so we can grow and work to undo racism in Indianapolis.
So before we go much further, because I'm sure people are going to be curious about this, where can they go to get information about the series itself? Is there a cost for people to attend, or can they just show up? Pam, I'll start with you on that.
Yeah, the program is free, and you can learn more about it at racedialogues.org, racedialogues.org. We are asking people to RSVP, but it's not necessary. We have strategies and plenty of facilitators available to help manage those discussions at the MLK Center.
Okay, give the URL just one more time.
racedialogues.org.
Okay. We are talking about race in honor of Spirit in Place's Powerful Conversations on Race series, which kicks off this coming Sunday. If you want to join the conversation, you can call us at 866-476-3881. You can find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI, track us down on Twitter at WFYI, or you can do what our regular listener Jerry has done and send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Jerry writes, "I've never been black or female or gay, but I've been poor, and that was tough enough. Racial attitudes are deeply personal. How exactly can we achieve the personal engagement required to affect these deeply personal attitudes?" Shonda, I'm going to start with you on that one, but I'd like to hear everybody's thoughts.
Well, I think it's complicated. I think, first of all, what has happened in our country is we don't have a dialogue, and we actually don't understand the history of how we got to here. So just even the notion that slavery was America's original sin, that was one of two original sins, the other being the genocide of the Native American peoples. Mm-hmm. And when we choose to not have these conversations, we keep spinning off different myths, and we really don't understand what has happened. Many of our citizens have lived in places of poverty, which is then compounded about race, which is then compounded by different types of violence, and our unwillingness to come to the table to start to learn these histories. Not necessarily the histories that they teach you in the textbooks in school, but actually the complexity of how we got to here creates the space for us to allow ignorance to grow and allow us not to even challenge ourselves. And it's really easy a lot of times to not want to push yourself to where you're uncomfortable, or what we like to call the growing edge, where what you think you know isn't true, or what you think you know has to be challenged. And this is a space for us to be uncomfortable so that we can have the conversations that are necessary. So I guess just so people understand, when we talk about a brave space, it's not a space where you're going to come, be able to say what you want to say, and not be challenged and not be pushed to be uncomfortable. Because if the conversation's not uncomfortable, then in some ways we're not having a real conversation. We're still having that sugar-coated conversation or that surface conversation that we typically have in our communities.
Yeah, what was it Oscar Wilde said? An idea that is not dangerous is unworthy of being called an idea.
There you go. And, you know, too, the book that we've, and this is not a book discussion group. I feel like we need to emphasize that this is not a book discussion group. The book is source material we'll be using.
So
but you don't have to read
quiz.
It. You're not going to fail it. There's no test. You don't have to come in with your book in hand. I mean, it's great if you want to take your personal growth to that level and get the book and read it. We encourage that. But that's not what it's about. But in fact, the Charleston syllabus came about because of this lack of knowledge about our history. You want to give a little story about that, LaShonda?
Well, you know, the book itself came about because of the Dylann Roof shootings down in Charleston. And we like to take that conversation to, well, he was mentally ill. And the reality is, no, he wasn't mentally ill. Shooting black people in churches and blowing up black churches and things like that has been a part of our history. And so the authors of the book, in response to the making sure that people understand there's a reason and there's a precedent for how we got to him coming into a church and shooting people, started actually what they called hashtag Charleston Syllabus First, which was an online crowd sourcing of information, which turned into a 21-page bibliography with literally every line of that 21 pages being a different source materials that people can look at. That's a lot, 21 pages with different articles and books. And so they looked at how do you reduce the discussion down to a book format that someone can still go from start to finish if they wanted to, reading the book itself and the additional source material if they wanted to really get a foundation of how we started from A to how we end up here at our particular racial moment in our society.
I wanted to give Jeff a chance also to respond to Jerry's question about how can we achieve the personal engagement required to affect deeply personal attitudes about race?
Well, people have to be real, you know, and like LaShonda said, be willing to go to that level of discomfort, because that's where our growing edge is when we're willing to be uncomfortable in situations. That's what it's all about, wrestling through these hard issues. And as a white person, you know, white folks in the United States, we have the privilege to participate or not participate. Some white folks believe it hasn't impacted them or they can ignore it. But the Civil War, many deaths were in the Civil War over the issue of our economy and slavery. And so it has affected white people, whether or not all will acknowledge that or not. So it's important to engage and be real about it and show genuine care for other people and work towards equity.
Well, we did a show, actually, on the whole notion of white privilege a few weeks ago, and the presumption that at some level, even the argument that people who are not of Western European ancestry are the ones who have race, and that the rest of us do not. That race is in fact a universal human quality. The presumption is that at some level race is the issue for other people and not for us. That we are the norm. Pam, I wanted to give you a crack also at Jerry's question.
You know, My gut reaction is just simply to have the initiative to have the conversations. I think so many of us are completely unwilling or frightened or scared to have that uncomfortable conversation or to be in space where we may feel like we might not understand or we might not know or we have to listen to a differing perspective. And, you know, at the root of all change begins in these kinds of conversations, where we can hear different perspectives and share different perspectives, and where we can, find our common humanity in that as well.
We are talking about race here on No Limits. The hook for the conversation is the start of Spirit and Place's Powerful Conversations on Race series, which kicks off this Sunday. If you want to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, or you can track us down on Twitter at WFYI. My guests are Pam Hinkle. She is Spirit and Place's Executive Director. LaShonda Crowstorm. She is Director of Community Engagement for Spirit and Place. And Jeff Howell, a facilitator for the Powerful Conversations on Race series. Again, I am John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking today about race. The hook for the conversation is the start of Spirit and Place's Powerful Conversations on Race series, which will run for a year, kicks off this Sunday. My guests are Pam Hinkle, who is Spirit and Place's executive director, LaShonda Crowstorm, who is director of community engagement for Spirit and Place, and Jeff Howell, a facilitator for the Powerful Conversations on Race series. If you want to join the conversation, you can do what a listener named Heidi has done and find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI. Heidi writes, is there an age minimum recommended for the series by Spirit and Place? My kids range from 4 to 13, and I'd love to include them in this. And then she has a follow-up. If this particular program isn't the appropriate venue for children, could your guests please recommend something similar geared toward young people? LaShonda.
Well, she has babies, but we would say at 18 because the conversations can get rough. I would also look at Child Advocates Undoing Racism program. They do have a program that's specifically targeted toward youth. They do it about 2 or 3 times here in Indy. I know a few weeks ago, we were talking about bringing another youth-oriented version back here this fall. But that, again, is for about 13 up. I would also, you can look on Race Dialogues. We will start having some resources there. So as we kind of crowdsource this, in general, it's almost like fifth grade up is really, just doing some of my other work around race, that fifth grade up is really a good place to start, because it allows children to engage back with you. Another resource is actually tolerance.org, which is a resource that's developed by the Southern Poverty Law Center that's specifically for children, and they do elementary and younger, but they have resources there to help you look at how to have the conversation or things to help raise your children in a manner that they are respectful of differences and celebrate it. But those are for the really younger children, tolerance.org, and those are resources that you can work to help get into your schools. And for here, look at Child Advocates for their upcoming Undoing Racism program that focuses around youth.
How long do these conversations typically last? Because that's also, if you've got children, asking them to be involved in what is maybe a 2 or 3 hour conversation is a bit much. Jeff, how long do you structure or facilitate?
The conversations on race, we're anticipating an hour and a half to 2 hours time frame.
So that's a long time for kids to sit still, too.
Yeah.
So that's a factor as well. We are talking about race here on No Limits. If you want to join the conversation, you can do what a listener named Margaret has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Margaret, welcome to the program.
Thank you. I just want to, it's kind of along the lines of the last question or comment. I just really want to encourage people, when you're talking about something that's so important, that we speak in common language and avoid jargon, because that can really turn people off, shut them out very quickly, and just be mindful of the language that we use when we're talking about things that are so important to everyone, that we use common words, not just sort of jargon that is a part of our industry or our field of study.
Could you perhaps give some examples, Margaret, of what you're talking about to illustrate?
Oh, I don't want to, I can't call out particular words, but there was some terminology used earlier by some of your guests that just, they're flagged by the industry that they work in. So just be careful about our jargon.
Okay, well,
use jargon.
Thank you very much for the call and the comment, Margaret. So there is, though, and Margaret, I'm going to take the liberty of reframing this a little bit. One of it struck me, you know, as an observer of this, and you know, in one fashion or another, it seems like I've been talking about race as an American now for more than five decades. It is that there is a kind of communication barrier there, that often when we are talking, we will be saying things, and this seems to flow both ways, and think somehow we're communicating something, but the message isn't being received in the way that we intend it, or that there is some cultural inhibition, and this generally, I think, is more the case with white people, where their lack of experience just doesn't allow them to process what is being said, to accept and render it. How do we get past that kind of barrier? And I guess I could just simplify this. Why is it so difficult for us to talk about race? It has been one of the biggest problems in this country, one of the biggest challenges now since the origin of the nation, and we still struggle just to talk about it. LaShonda, I'm going to start with you. I want everybody's thoughts on that, because that's a big question.
Well, I mean, let's just be honest. If we're going to be honest about things, then we have to have a really honest conversation. And unless you're willing to start talking about what is white privilege, what does it mean to have white privilege, unless white Americans are willing to take on their white family members who have racist ideas, this is where the conversations have to start. It's really easy for a white person to come and talk to a brown person and say, hey, tell me about race in America. That's very different than for you to turn around and say, hey, Uncle such and such at the dining room table, this isn't right, and this is why it isn't right. And these are resources that you need to do. So everyone's happy to do the kind of sugar-coated conversation out in the community. People aren't willing to do the hard conversation, which begins with looking in the mirror about why you carry certain ideas. What are you willing to give up in our society so that you can have a society that's built around equity and ensuring that everyone gets access? And if you don't know the answer, are you willing to go do some research and do some of your own self-development to learn about these histories and actually how they impact our current reality? So people like to start this whole idea with, well, I didn't do anything. You may have not have done anything, but are you living with the impact that you live in a society that has been set up for you to benefit? And so you didn't do anything to create that society, but you're benefiting from it. So are you willing to undo that and start working in a way so that everyone can benefit regardless? And lots of people don't want to give up that. So I would say we can look at the panel here and ask everyone at this panel. Mm-hmm. And you don't have to ask me. You just have to be honest with yourself. What are you really willing to give up right now? What are you really willing to do to advance the topics around equity and justice in our communities? Are you willing to go back in your workplace and challenge your workplace when you see that they aren't doing right? And a lot of these issues, they don't have to be grand things. They have to really require people to have courage and to have a backbone to speak up and to challenge. But that means that you're also going to have to make some kind of sacrifice, or you're going to there's going to be a backlash against you personally. And I'll just be honest with you. just off topic, I do a project around the history of lynching, and I've been running this project 15 years around the United States. And very few people are willing to actually take a little stand in even their own communities to talk about what's happened in their own communities. So when we talk about why does it keep happening and happening, keep in mind my grandfather walked here from when he was 15 years old from Mississippi because he knew that if he stayed there, he would die. That was the night, that was just after, that was like 1932. What could have happened to him? Think about what was happening in 1932 in this country. So I know those histories, but why is it that a lot of white Americans don't know those histories around lynching and sharecropping or all those issues that still we live with the ramifications of them today? But I think you should really start talking to some of your white guests here as well, because they have other perspectives on why they're going to do this work in our society to make it a better society.
Deep denial among white people.
Yeah.
Deep, deep denial.
And I guess what I would say, LaShonda, part of the reason I throw the conversation is that one of the complaints we often hear is that it is one thing for white people to talk about what the racial problems are in this country. It's another thing for the people who have had that experience. So I want to make sure that we're giving voice to you here. Pam.
Yeah, I'll say it again, deep denial. I mean, I think that it's so much easier to be in denial. And for, you know, white folks like me who were raised in highly homogenous communities, that denial is just even easier. And it's painful to look at the realities of the history that a lot of us didn't learn or learn the extent of that history. We have passing knowledge of that history. Sure, there was slavery, whatever. But we don't go deeply and understand the generational impacts of that history. And, you know, I can say I want to acknowledge something. Like I'm sitting here as a white person in the WFY studio talking about race and racism, and my heart is beating very fast, okay, because I'm still uncomfortable about it. I'm still, and I feel like a new student myself, and I've taken the Undoing Racism training offered by Child Advocates, which I cannot recommend enough, and I've done my homework and my reading, and my eyes have been opened, and now that I have seen, I can't unsee. So for an organization like Spirit and Place and anybody who's committed to any kind of equity, we are part of the problem if we're not actively working around issues of equity and justice. So that's this work is part of my eyes having been opened by LaShonda as she's come on our staff a couple and a half years ago, and by the work we continue to do around issues of equity, always for Spirit and Place through the lens of the arts, humanities, and religion, because that's where we—that's where our genius is. But it's just denial. It's hard. It's hard to think that I have to, you know, talk to my uncle so-and-so about his racism at the dinner. And I don't want to do that because I value getting along over that. But that is how it's going to happen. And so, you know, how does that connect to this program that we're doing? You know, we're hoping this gives people some tools and some beginning frameworks so they can have conversations. But it does, it really does boil down to getting past our denial, informing ourselves of the realities of how white privilege has impacted our country and the systems we currently are grappling with. And starting the hard work one to one that we need to do as white folks. I don't know how Jeff would add to that.
Jeff?
Yeah, I think we go back to there's a saying we can't change what we don't acknowledge, and so we have to go back to elementary school where our history books in this country were whitewashed. Pun intended, but they were whitewashed to paint the glory of the white American empire and how great the white folks are. We still got all the monuments, which that's been in the news lately.
Anticipating my next line of questions.
Oh, okay. All right.
That's okay.
All right, great. And, you know, the Confederate flags waving and holidays, you know, still every year comes around, Thanksgiving, Columbus Day. Why are we still having these celebrations? They're basically white holidays that maintain the glory of the white American empire. And then some white folks will fight back and say, well, you're anti-patriotic if you talk about this, or my great-grandfather was in this war. And it's not that at all. It's just getting real about what the truth is, that the United States was founded on the sins of racism with the Native Americans and slavery 400 years ago to build up white wealth. And then we had in our current political climate, it's even in the past 9 months gone up tremendously. Even I was sad to say today, see today they ended the DACA program, mm-hmm. and Jeff Sessions is propagating racism by still continuing to demonize the immigrants. That, you know, it's compassionate. It's not compassionate to keep DACA because we got to keep these bad people out. And so he's propagating this white lie against people of color. It continues on. And then also there's the institutional racism, which we go into depth at the Undoing Racism seminars that LaShonda and Pam mentioned, where people of color are the ones who have built up the white wealth. And so we don't want racism to go away if we were benefiting from the greed. And since racism is beneficiary to white people, it's we white folks that have to take responsibility for the house we did not build to undo racism.
So we've talked about this question, and before I go into the next big thing, we've gotten an email from a listener named Pat, and again, if you want to reach us by email, you can find us at nolimits@wfyi.org. Pat asks that we please repeat the URL with spelling. She says, I tried finding the site using the American spelling and received a page offering to sell the domain. After some research, I found that I'll ask for confirmation on this. It is www.racedialogues, and dialogues is spelled dialogues.org. Again, that is www.racedialogues.org. So history has been part of this focus. We talked about the monuments. It is something, though, that the past has never really settled, it seems like. I mean, I've thought also of the dust-up here in Indiana a few years ago with former Governor Mitch Daniels and Howard Zinn's book. And, you know, President Daniels now, Purdue University, former Governor Daniels, argument was that this is just completely out of perspective. There's no mention of the Gettysburg Address, or Abraham Lincoln only gets two. It seems to me that if you read Zinn's book, it was really trying to tell the American story from the perspective of the victims, as it were, or the folks who were left behind by historical forces or affected and harmed by historical movements. We're still having that discussion today about these monuments, about whether they are appropriate. Pam, I'll start with you. How much does history play into this, and how should we view that history and come to terms with it? And we may have to continue this after the break, because it too is a big question.
It's a big question. I mean, you said it yourself, Henry. History is, it's continuously unpacked, and we revisit it again and again. I think, you know, the key to our own growth is to let it continuously be alive and continue to look at it in all the new things we learn about it, and not fix it in one place and time, and to not let one narrative dominate. But that is often how things have proceeded. And things that are like monuments and physical representations of that history have a way of fixing it in space, which then can be problematic.
We are talking about race here on No Limits. If you want to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at NoLimitsWFYI, or you can track us down on Twitter at WFYI. My guests are Pam Hinkle. She is Executive Director of Spirit and Place. LaShonda Crowe Storm, who is Director of Community Engagement for Spirit and Place, and Jeff Howell, who is a facilitator for the Powerful Conversations on Race series. That's the hook for this show, is the Powerful Conversations on Race series, which launches this Sunday afternoon. I am John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I'm John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking about race today on No Limits in honor of the launch of Spirit and Place's Powerful Conversations on Race series, which begins this Sunday. It's going to be a year-long series of conversations. My guests are Pam Hinkle. She is Spirit and Place's executive director, LaShonda Crowe Storm, who is Director of Community Engagement for Spirit and Place, and Jeff Howell, a facilitator for the Powerful Conversations on Race series. If you want to join the conversation, you can do what a listener named Deborah has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Deborah, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Certainly.
My question is a question I know the answer to, but are we worried that not enough of the people that really, truly need this program will not attend? I'm planning on being there. I'm very excited. I want to learn how I can help make a change. I'm white. That's in my heart. It has been for a long time. But, you know, there are going to be people that we all know who would benefit. They don't even realize they'd benefit. But in other words, are there going to be a lot of people like me there, and we all agree? Are we going to be taught how to help others?
Thanks very
much. Tackle this problem?
Yeah, thanks very much for the call. We've gotten an email question from a listener named Charles that's similar to that. Thanks again for the call, Deborah, where he says it would seem that the people who would most need this conversation would not be attendees. What to do? That is sort of the classic with these things. Do we end up just preaching to the choir here?
Well, I would say that there is no choir, because even quote-unquote people who feel like that they're in the know and that they're woke and they're quote-unquote liberal, and the word I hate the most is colorblind, because that usually means you're very blind to what's going on around you, that they can come to these places, have conversations that they may have had mentally but not have actually had publicly, that they can connect with other like-minded people. And secondly, that the real conversation happens at that dinner table when Uncle John or Aunt Betty says whatever, and that hopefully they have some courage at that moment to speak up. Because the people who need to hear this, they may or may not come. We see them sometimes even at some of the other discussions we have. You just never know. But everyone who comes and everyone who chooses not to come has the option and the responsibility, if they're really saying that they want a different America, to speak up in the moment, to speak up in your workplace, to speak up in your church, to look at your own policies and procedures in those environments where you inhabit on a daily basis, and look at how you can do better to make it equitable. So our conversations are a catalyst to help whoever wants to come to do better. But the real change is when we start to have those difficult conversations right in the moment. And just with some of our Gentrify series, people brought relatives along who hadn't heard about some of the issues that we were dealing with around education and gentrification. So you don't know who's going to come to the conversation, but I would say come. Bring someone who you think needs to come with you, and then be willing to engage those conversations where you're at in those difficult spaces. They're usually very private and very, sometimes they're private, sometimes they're really public, especially if you're taking on talking to issues in your workplace.
I want to return, because I tossed the question about history and how we deal with it, to Pam, but I really want to hear your thoughts as well, Jeff and LaShonda. I'll tell you what, I'll give Jeff the first crack. LaShonda gets the last word then. All right? Jeff.
In history, yeah. Again, we can't change what we don't acknowledge. And I think kind of what Deb's question was earlier too, you know, about who's going to be there. This, the truth, I mean, history should be history. I think it's very offensive that, you know, we gave blacks one of the shortest months of the year so they can have Black History Month. That's an insult. History should be history. It should be true. And the things that Howard Zinn puts in and fills in the gaps that the white history books left out should be a part of it, I think. I've read that. And that we should just get the facts and not be taught that white is right and just the glory of whiteness. We should have all the truth in, the good and the bad, so we can all wrestle through it and process it together and form how we want to deal with that.
How much of this, LaShonda, I'm going to reframe it ever so slightly because Jeff touches on something here that I think is important, is that, you know, often American history is presented as this march toward progress or march toward success. And as a result, even aside from the sort of racial dynamics that have plagued this country, we take away a lot of the messiness of human life here.
Preach.
Very few of us, you know, see an unbridled ascension to success in life. And we make mistakes. We have things we regret. We have all of that sort of stuff. How much of it is we just don't have a realistic view about what life is, and therefore we don't have a realistic view about race. We don't have a realistic view about gender. Mm-hmm. We don't have a realistic view about a lot of things.
Well, there is a lot of questions.
There is.
I would say just in general.
Pick the one you like the most and go with that. Okay.
Well, I'll pick a perspective.
Okay.
So I would say that in general that we always have to challenge our mythologies that deal with pull yourself up by your bootstraps. Because, again, if you knew that history, you would know that these issues around affirmative action have always been for white people, that the earliest affirmative action programs in the United States began in the 1600s when we landed here, when Europeans landed on the soil. But if you don't understand those histories or how they work themselves out, if you don't acknowledge what happened as you move this progress forward, then how can you really understand what happens? I mean, we live in Indiana. It means land of Indians. Where are the Native American populations? They're not here. So if you're not willing to actually even take something as simple as that and talk about, well, what happened to the populations? So fourth grade in Indiana, students are learning about Indiana geography and history. Are they learning also about the tribes that used to live here? And then having the discussion where, what happened to those tribes? Are we talking about, as students learn and they grow and they talk about the Underground Railroad, they understand that Indiana was a state that wasn't a slaveholding state. It was actually a very friendly state that many people came to escape. But if you have that conversation, you also have to have the other conversation, which is, so what happened between the end of slavery and the rise of the Ku Klux Klan in our communities? So what happened in our state? That's a broader and much more complicated discussion, but you have to have it. And so even with this issue with the monuments, so one side of it is that we should keep them and learn the history, but are you learning the whole history that's attached to why that monument is there? We don't put up monuments of Benedict Arnold, but we really are talking about, in some ways, issues that dealt with groups of states trying to be a different country.
Oh, treason, yeah.
I mean, so is that treason?
It makes that, yeah.
So,
and that point has been...
So think about that. You can't just have those discussions and put them in this real kind of rosy-colored mythology that makes you feel good. You actually have to put them in a space that allows you to have an honest conversation.
Well, we did a show about Indiana's history, dealing obviously with the fact that we were the only state in the country where the Klan actually got control of state government at one point. And it was not long after the Charleston tragedy and the issue with the Confederate battle flag and, you know, these monuments came up. One of the guests was the historian James Madison from IU, who made what I thought was an important distinction. There's a difference between acknowledging the evil or bad moments in your past and celebrating those moments.
Mm-hmm.
The Klan, you know, Indiana, we should be teaching about the Klan in our schools. I'm paraphrasing his arguments. You know, making sure that it is in our museums. It is a place where, and in our books when we tell a story, doesn't mean, though, that we should be flying a white sheet from the top of the State House to say that this was a proud moment in our history. We are talking about race here on No Limits. If you want to join the conversation, you can do what a listener named Jan has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Jan, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Appreciate you taking my call.
Certainly. What's on your mind?
I have three comments. The first one was that I really, really believe that we need to start the discussion with our children much younger than fifth grade. It's been proven that children as young as two are quite understanding of the differences between whites and other colors, and that it starts there, and it starts in the home when they're, you know, removing their children from a daycare that might have more black children than white. It's proven in schools in first grade where parents remove their children because the black community has overrun the school. That's my first comment. My second comment is that I've lived in Indianapolis all my life, and I had a circumstance that came up when my child was going to go to school in a north side school, and I ran into a person and I said, you know, what's the racial diversity of the school? And the person said to me, well, there are only two brown children in the school, and they're children of doctors. And I asked her specifically, what is the racial diversity? What do you attribute that to? And she told me that the buses don't run north of 86th Street. And she also told me she was a teacher in that school. Lastly, I had a circumstance where I come to a public place daily, which I am there right now, where on January 1st of 2016, on a whiteboard in a public place, the individual who owns this place put only one more year of that awful black person. So my sense of race in the state of Indiana is that we have come no further than we were when the Ku Klux Klan was elected.
Thanks.
And I feel so sad about that.
Thanks very much for the call and for sharing your thoughts, Jan.
So thank you.
Certainly. So Jan's call leads to another line of questioning I had. You know, there's a lot of analysis out there that shows that, for example, the election of the first African-American as president in this country's history brought a lot of this stuff again to the surface that had been buried. And that is disturbing at a lot of levels, but there are people out there right now who are saying, actually, this is good because we need to be talking about this. And the only way we're going to talk about it is if it doesn't stay buried, if we get it out in the open and we discuss it. So it's the fact that we do seem to be having, you know, much more naked, open, in your face kind of racial tension in this country right now, a good thing or a bad thing, Pam?
I think it's a good thing. I agree that we can't deal with the problems if they're all under the surface. And it's easy to live in our denial and pretend it's not real. So I think, although it's painful, and that, you know, everyone in my circle is like, what do we do about this? And I can't believe it, and it's hard. But I think it's also what's provoking a lot of institutions to really look more carefully at their roles in creating equity and justice. And it's and this is happening in the arts and culture community. It's happening in the philanthropic community. It's happening in lots of layers. And lots of us who are white who realize that we have roles and responsibilities as gatekeepers in certain systems are feeling a much more profound responsibility to act and redirect so that we can, you know, have a hope for that kind of a future that we want.
Jeff.
Yeah, I think that's a positive thing. You know, obviously some people have used it as an opportunity in the last 9 months to be emboldened, to be more outspoken with their racist attitudes. But there's been a some rallies recently where I understand there were more anti-racist protesters that came out and ended up shutting down the white supremacists, and they kind of had to hide with leave with their tails between their legs. So that's a good thing that it seems like there's a more positive against it. But our institutions definitely need to get real about it, and white folks, we need to take responsibility for working towards equity. And again, white folks sometimes we can make excuses. Well, my family didn't own any slaves, but we have to take responsibility for the house we didn't build, even though we may not personally had a hand in some of these things, and take responsibility for what we do have now and can do.
LaShonda.
So I'm a black woman in America.
Yes,
yeah. So race
it's
very difficult. So yeah. It's different. So tense racial moments are on par with daily existence almost. Yeah. So in some respects, what we are witnessing is a crisis of white people's unconscious of having to be honest about what their society looks like. Protests are good. Dialogues are good. But that's only step one. And it really determines what the next step is if we are actually going to start looking at institutional racism, start forcing and remodeling our institutions, rechanging how our society functions, because we can dialogue all day and nothing changes. But it does mean going back and looking at all of it, the totality of that history, going back into the spaces we live in and work in and worship in, and actually looking at how to make those spaces equitable. Because we can talk about it, which is step one. We can protest, which is you don't really want Nazis and things running down your street. But if you really want to change, you have to take the next step and actually start doing a restructuring of our institutions and not stop. So if we've started this conversation today, this is what this conversation has to look like for the next decade, nonstop, if we really want that change to occur. The principles of Agopic Energy Campaign, they give you like a step-by-step of how to do this. East Point Peace Academy actually has a 250-year peace plan about step-by-step, decade-by-decade, what has to occur in order for you to transform. So we really have to think about that in the long haul. What does it mean? What is step one? What do we need to do? Dialogue is step one, but then we've got to be willing to move to step two, three, four, and five to actually change it.
Yeah, and the 250 years also is a reference to Lincoln's second inaugural, where he says that the 250 years that have been drawn by the lash, it's much more poetic than that, will have to be atoned for with another 250 years. So this is a long process, a long conversation. We made at least a little bit of a start today, I hope.
Definitely.
Real quickly, Pam, before I let you go, the URL if people want to find more information.
RaceDialogues.org. That's RaceDialogues.org.
S.
Thank
dot
you.
.org. You've been listening to No Limits. I am John Kroll. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Producer, Shannon Cagle. Interactive Media Coordinator, Scott McAllister. Technical Producers, Cedric Freeman and Chris Flood. And Board Engineer, Joe Hatcher. No Limits is made available through IPBS, Indiana's Public Broadcasting Stations.